Welcome to another episode of Science to Business with Gary Riccio, that's me, and Nathan Roman. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, Gary.
it's good to see you after our time at Emmett's Pub the other day, even though the outcome of the Kings-Ranger game wasn't to my liking. So in the context of, you know, sports psychology and the Kings, we wound up talking a lot about leadership the other night, Nathan. And we said we'd, you know, kind of spend this program talking a little bit more about, you know, leadership, you know, not just in coaching, but as it manifests in athletes and other people who are involved in sporting activities. So
right.
I'm going to hand it over to you to kind of, you know, frame the conversation and start it off.
Right. And for those that are, you know, we see all these leadership books coming out of, you know, Harvard, MIT, whatever it may be, and we see the CEO, we see the managers, we have all this great data and research. And for me, like, one of the reasons I love sports, and you and I have spoken about this, is that I don't have 24/7 access to Goldman Sachs or Amazon. What I do have 24/7 access to are the Lakers or the Warriors in this case, or the Yankees, whomever it may be. I'm able to watch grown adults, men and women, who are the best in the world at what they do, working in a team setting, trying to maximize their potential for a common goal, in this case, winning championships. That's one of the reasons that keeps me fascinated about sports.
Well, that's really interesting. And, you know, while it kind of seems, you know, obvious after the fact, once you say it, it's I don't know that I've ever thought about, you know, watching sports in that particular way. I mean, I've obviously thought about, as many other people have, examples of leadership in sports, but the idea of consuming it to find examples, to be looking in advance for examples of leadership is really kind of interesting, because it is much more accessible than things you might get from consulting or from various publications. It's certainly less expensive, and it certainly is much more entertaining. So
exactly.
that's a really interesting observation. So,
and for me, being an LA fan, I've been very blessed to have these great examples throughout my 35 plus years of living, of watching great athletes combined with some very good coaching, and unfortunately with also some really, really bad coaching as well. Okay, so the most recent one for us, you know, which was ironic or coincidental, back-to-back, going from Phil Jackson to Mike Brown. For those who don't know who Phil Jackson is, he's won 11 NBA titles. He won 6 with the Bulls, with Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and a great supporting crew. Then he won another 5 with the Lakers, mainly with Kobe, Shaq, and then also great supporting crew.
Well, you're missing 2 other titles he won.
5 and 6, 11?
With the New York Knicks as a player.
Oh.
You have trouble with this New York thing, you guys from L.A.
See, the great thing is the Knicks are my second favorite team, just because I consider New York home, so it doesn't sting as much. It just hurts because Jerry West only got 1 title.
Right.
To me, that's what hurts most. But no, those Knicks teams, that's one of the epitomes of just team play and just smart players. I was really jealous of those teams.
Yeah.
Of course, my Lakers had to play.
So what I really like about, you know, what you're starting to talk about here in the context of leadership and actually as a consumer and somebody who's trying to learn from great leaders is to do comparisons. You know, not just to look for examples of good leadership, but to actually compare good leadership with leadership that's not so good, you know, to try to understand what's different.
Right, and when you see it literally back to back, going from Phil Jackson and his triangle offense and his philosophy on letting the players have this creative autonomy to do what they do best and to figure things out. And he understands that basketball, like life, is a process. And he saw that you had to work it out and you had to go through the ups and the downs. And ultimately, you would crescendo to the point where you peak at the right time and win a championship. And he knew his job as a coach wasn't just to teach X's and O's and to do in-game adjustments, but was also to help facilitate that as a leader, saying, okay, I know what you're going through, and I know this sucks, well, I know this is great, but this is what may be happening next, and what you're going through now, don't fight it, or go through this and fight through it, or whatever it may be. Phil had that understanding.
And he was well-read. I mean, actually, when he was on, you know, again, I mean, I'll make a quick, you know, sort of reference to that ESPN 30 for 30 series, and specifically the one on the 1970, when the Garden was Eden, the 1970 New York Knicks. You know, the intellectuals that were on that team, you know, were really pretty amazing. You know, and
Bradley and him alone, there are the intellectuals. I would just love to have dinner with those two, just those two.
Yeah, and there were others that we won't go into right now, but that were pretty amazing people in terms of their intellectual abilities. But the fact is that, you know, Phil Jackson is well read, and there is a lot, you know. So what he's most noted for being well read about is philosophy, and Eastern philosophy in particular. But it's not just philosophy, right? Philosophy is important, and I told you even in my work with the United States Army that existential philosophy wound up being very important in our helping the Army codify what good training was. But there also is science, right, that dovetails very nicely with the philosophy that informs leadership. You know, and I'll want to hear, you know, some of the things that, you know, you've found most useful in your career, Nathan. But, you know, in my case, I mentioned it last time, it's sort of Maslow and Bandura, you know, are sort of the gods, if you will, of psychological science when it comes to the kind of autonomy you're talking about, right? Which is, you know, personal initiative balanced by accountability, you know, choice balanced by responsibility, individuality that's inseparable for understanding your place in a team or a community. You know, Maslow and Bandura, they're just nobody, you know, just the volume and importance of things that they did are really useful. There are many other sources, and we'll provide some of those in the blog post. You know, everything from existential psychology and positive psychology to more recent things like self-determination theory. Self-determination theory has been around for a while, but its popularity has kind of gone through the roof in the last decade. And the thing I like most about self-determination theory is it overlaps a lot with Bandura's social learning theory, but you know it's a little bit simpler and more focused. And the focus that I like the most and that I found most useful in my own work on leadership with the Army is the balance of, you know, what they refer to as autonomy and relatedness. And that's the key to individual motivation that enables people to rise to a higher level of performance.
And I think one of the beauties of Phil, and I'll juxtapose it with Mike Brown in a second, is that Phil understood a person, particularly grown athletic men, grown athletes who are the best in what they do in terms of combining both their skill and the talent that they've worked years at doing with also their confidence / arrogance and how to play towards that so that they can maximize it. Mike Brown, on the other hand, great defensive tactician. That's why he was under Greg Popovich in San Antonio. And he has had some, you know, head coaching success when he took the Cavaliers to the 2007 finals. But looking back, one of the things that you heard consistently when Mike Brown took over for the Lakers was how micromanaging he was. And I'm sure he was micromanaging, but also in comparison to Phil, who was not just laissez-faire, he was just, you do what you're going to do because you're a grown man, you know what you can do, you have this creative autonomy, to somebody who was very much rigid by the X's and O's. And I knew it was towards the end. I knew he was almost done when he brought in this guy named Jordan, who used to be the head coach for the Wizards. And he brought in the Princeton offense, which is very much like the triangle, which means that you have your players read the defense and you figure it out for yourself. You have certain responsibilities and roles, and you have a parameter to work within. But essentially, if you see the defense is doing something to you that is not congruent with what you're supposed to be doing with your role, then you figure it out and you work it out with your teammates so that you guys can make it happen. But by that time, it was too late. Mike Brown was pretty much done, even when he got all this great talent. And the juxtaposition is that Mike Brown didn't understand how to – he had great X's and O's, great defensive tactician, but he didn't know how to manage the talent to let them flourish on their own. And, you know, what is very counterintuitive is being able to say, to set them free and say, you've been doing this for years. You're literally the best in the world. I want to be here to help facilitate some stuff. But in essence, it's really in your hands. And we have to work together as a team to be able to balance that so that you are the one flourishing. You're the ones out on the courts. And you're the ones that are figuring out what exactly to do in this context of this game.
So, you know, in science, one of the things that, you know, we worry about, and, you know, Nathan and I are talking about this all the time, you have to continually check yourself, which is why it's so important to have colleagues in a broader community that's sort of calling you out on simple mistakes in thinking. You know, one of the things you worry about in science, especially in the social and behavioral sciences, is the fallacy of affirming the consequent. You know, so what do I mean by that in this particular context? You know, we've got a difference between two coaches, one that did really well with the LA Lakers, one that did not do really well with the LA Lakers. And we can obviously, they're very different in their styles. And we can attribute that, you know, that difference in success to their styles. And if that's the only evidence that you're using to say that Phil Jackson was a good leader, and Brown was not, that's not necessarily logically correct, right? So, for example, it's a difference, but not necessarily a difference that matters. So I might ask you, the question is, you know, is that difference always something that's going to lead to better leadership? And, you know, so one way of asking this question so that we're not making a logical error is, you know, are there some teams and situations for which micromanagement would be good leadership and lead to good outcomes?
Depending on who your talent is and the contents. In this situation, because the team that Mike Brown inherited was the one that Phil was coaching, used to that culture of, let's see, from essentially 1998 to 2010, having that culture of the creative autonomy and Phil's philosophy of coaching. Then they bring in Mike Brown after Phil retires, and then to have this different coaching philosophy, which was very much more micromanaging, very much rubbed some of the players, and particularly Kobe, the wrong way. Kobe very much, you know, he didn't throw Mike Brown under the bus, but especially when he talked about having the freedom to do what they need to do on the court, or when Jordan was brought in and how much he just profusely was grateful for this Princeton offense to be implemented. It was very much some of the indicators that, okay, this team wanted that. Like I said, Mike Brown took the 2007 Cavaliers to the NBA Finals.
Right, so that's an important data point, right? So there's a team for which, at least to a point, that system seemed to work.
Correct.
You know, that sort of optimization approach to management, you know, you could say works really well, just as with any kind of optimization, when the environment doesn't change. You know, the 21st century is you know, defined by change. I mean, it change is accelerating. Yes, there was plenty of change in the 20th century. But, you know, the rate of change just clearly is faster in the 20th century, 21st century. All businesses write about it, talk about it, struggle with it. It's real. It's just not clear that there are very many contexts in which the optimizing micromanagerial strategy will work. There probably are some, but I think they're vanishing. And, you know, and I think in sport, you see that as well. I mean, I think the rate of innovation in sport is much more rapid in the 21st century than it was in the 20th century.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, so it might not be that, you know, the Mike Brown style will ever work, at least not in the kinds of sport like basketball, where you may have design plays, but there's an awful lot of variation from that design. This is the kind of debate, right, that happens in science. You know, you say, okay, well, maybe we're interpreting too much into this difference in our case right now between Phil Jackson and Mike Brown. And then you start playing what-if scenarios, and then you start looking for other evidence or data that relates to sort of the alternative hypothesis.
I'd say Mike Brown might actually be a more successful college basketball coach.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because at that level, the mastery of skill for those athletes is not the same as the NBA. And Mike Brown, I think, would have more of the disposition to be able to relate and work with that level of maturity and still instilling the kind of discipline and boundaries that a college basketball player would need at that level.
Yeah, see, I'm thinking maturity is the bigger dimension
here,
that's right?
What I'm saying. Like, I think Mike Brown could win multiple national titles at a school where he could get the players that he needs.
Right, because I still think that, you know, if you had, for whatever reason, a college basketball team with players who were sufficiently mature to balance initiative and accountability, choice and responsibility, you know, they probably would win the national title. You know, but I think that's rare and that's hard, you know, at that age. I mean, it's very difficult at that age when you're so focused on, you know, developing yourself, and that's what everybody everywhere you go is evaluating you on your individual development. It's very difficult, right, to maintain and balance that with the mindset of the collective. You know, but the other thing I will say, you know, as we go back and forth between these two things is that our interpretations are also influenced by a body of science. You know, we mentioned Maslow and Bandura and self-determination theory. There's also a body of literature in business scholarship on this. You know, one of my favorite authors is Michael Roberto, who writes about this difference between a micromanagerial leadership style and one that is really more about oversight. You know, where there are boundaries, right, and there are guidelines, but there is the expectation that that people on the team are going to be taking a fair amount of initiative as, you know, unforeseen circumstances demand. So Nathan, you know, is there research that you want to mention that specifically within the field of sports psychology that relates to what we're talking about?
Yeah, actually it was in educational psychology. And I really am not trying to just refer to all the teams that I care about, but this was a study done back in the mid-70s with Coach John Wooden at UCLA, who is, you know, like the greatest coach ever because of winning 10 national titles, 7 in a row, 3 undefeated national seasons in a row. You know, like, this guy knew how to coach.
What did he win, like 80-something games in a row at one point?
88 straight games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
So it was just ridiculous.
Of course, we should also point out that the UConn's women's basketball team won 90 games in a row between 2008 and 2010. So maybe we ought to be looking for a study of Gino Auriemma as coach of the UConn's women's basketball team. This seems to be a good place to break. Let's come back in the next segment and pick up on leadership and sports psychology by talking a little bit more about the study from the early 1970s on John Wooden's coaching style. Bye for now.